Tonight I'm going to talk about mystery and the sense of a human being a mystery. What does it mean to understand ourselves as a mystery, understand others as a mystery? And I'm going to start in an odd place. I'm going to start in the brain and talking about some brain wiring, some neurobiology. Neurobiologists talk about two kinds of circuits, top-down and bottom-up circuits in the brain. Top-down circuits go from memory centers down to perceptual centers. Bottom-up circuits go from perceptual centers up to memory centers. So when we're looking at something we don't know, when we're trying to figure it out, we're in our bottom circuits looking carefully at it, and we're finding no matching memory for it. Or maybe we're learning it and we're building a memory for it. When we recognize something, we look at it and instantly our memory says, oh, I know what that is. And that's the top-down circuit. And we're able to say, oh, recognize it. And it's curious because, so for example, in early childhood, in infancy, children are in their bottom-up circuits all the time. They're trying to figure out the world. And the bottom-up circuits really, they have a sense of wonder to them, a sense of magic. And if you've ever looked at a child looking at the world, you know, that sort of wide-eyed, you know, taking everything in, that sort of thing. The bottom-up circuits really play a part in contributing to the magic of childhood, the sense of wonder. The sense of wonder all around, you know, that sort of thing. And so that's what's great about the bottom-up circuits. The top-down circuits, what's great about the top-down circuits is that they're incredibly efficient, you know. You know, once we learn what something is, we don't have to relearn it every time we pick it up. Like every time you pick up a fork, you don't have to refigure out what it is. You remember that it's a fork, that kind of thing. And so the top-down circuits are incredibly efficient. But the trouble is, by the time we get to adulthood, we're really surrounded by things that we recognize. You know, everything is known, 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 known. It's very rare that we ever encounter anything that we don't recognize. And when we're entirely in our top-down circuits, the world becomes kind of boring. It becomes weary, stale, flat, unprofitable. There's no juice to it. And it's a world devoid of wonder and magic. And so one way to combat that is actually the practice of mindfulness. So mindfulness is about taking a careful look at the world. Even though I know exactly what a fork is, and I've seen many forks in my life, I have no doubt what a fork is. Mindfulness is about looking at it for the first time. Even though I know what it is, can I really look at it? Can I study it? Can I take in all the intricacies of the curves and everything about its color, its shape, its weight, how it feels in my hand? And so mindfulness is about looking in incredible detail at the ordinary objects of life, you know? A stapler, a hammer, you know, anything like that, to just look at it and take it in very carefully. And of course, the left brain, which is the very efficient brain, says, well, what's the point of that? I know what it is. Why should I look at it? You know, that kind of thing. And it really takes a longer time for the right brain, the artistic brain, to sort of open up and come online, to appreciate the artistic sense of how the hammer is constructed, how the spoon is constructed, that sort of thing. And when we're looking like that, we're re-engaging our bottom-up circuits. When we look carefully at the world, we're re-engaging the bottom-up circuits. And if you find that you start to make a practice of looking at the world this way, and even something as simple as, you know, every time you go into someplace familiar, notice one detail you've never noticed before. You know, something like that. You know, every time you go into the same store, notice something you've never noticed before. Or, you know, on a typical walk in your neighborhood, notice one thing. It might be a flower, it might be a tree, you know, something that you've never really consciously looked at before, you know. It's really wonderful, incidentally, to be mindful of flowers, you know. And again, the left brain is just so quick. Oh, flowers. Okay, I know that, you know. But to allow the right brain to open up and really take in how miraculously beautiful each flower is, you know. And so when we're engaging in mindfulness, it brings more magic into life. It brings more a sense of wonder and play that is absent when we're in that totally efficient mode. And as the Zen people point out, and this is very paradoxical and not what the logical mind would expect at all, but if we really pay deep attention to the physical details of life, we'll have breakthrough experiences to the sacred. You know, and the Zen stories are absolutely full of this. The Zen master Tozan is weighing flax, and the student comes to him and says, "What is Buddha?" And Tozan says immediately, 3 pounds of flax. You know, in other words, he's having such an intimate experience of the flax that at that moment, the flax is the same as the Buddha body itself, you know. And so there's in a way, a magic and a mystery, even in just ordinary everyday reality, if we can look at it with deep mindfulness, and certainly if we can look at it with this kind of Zen mindfulness. And I'll say also, incidentally, because we were talking about anxiety a little earlier, mindfulness is also incredibly grounding when we just get into that deep space. First of all, it gets us out of our heads. It gets us into a more sensual place. But also there's something very calming about, you know, the chair is just being a chair. It doesn't want to be anything else. It's just being a chair. You know, the fire hydrant is just being a fire hydrant, you know, like everything is just sort of contently, calmly being what it is, you know, and there's something very grounding about that. So it's one thing to be mindful of, say, a fork or a flower. It's another thing to be mindful of a human being. And any human being is, you know, a little more complicated than a fork or a flower, you know. And of course, it's very complicated with human beings, especially the ones that we know well, the ones that, you know, romantic partners, dear friends. We have so many expectations and so many experiences and stories about who they are, you know. Can we see them with fresh eyes? In other words, am I so dumping expectations on this person close to me that I'm leaving no room for them to surprise me with who they are? You know, we talked a couple weeks ago about allowing. And there's very subtle things about allowing, because I don't think any of us would actually bluntly say to our friends or our lovers, I'm not going to allow you to be who you are. Like, no one's going to bluntly say that. But the way it often plays out is with a friend or a lover, suppose they start to show the edge of a new side of who they are, and it's something that threatens me a little bit. Then maybe I start to get a little bit defensive, and I might not even be aware of it, you know? But maybe my body language or the tone of my voice or something about my facial expression, I start to register defense. And then unconsciously they're picking up defense, and they, you know, they're my friend, they don't want to make me uncomfortable. So then they start putting away this part of themselves that's coming out, you know? And then likewise, the dynamic is happening both ways, you know, parts of me that are trying to come out, you know, I see it triggers the other person, I'm pulling it back. And this might be so subtle that people are not even aware that it's happening. But then suddenly the friendship or the romance gets to a point where suddenly it feels very stale. It's like there's no magic anymore. And why is this? And how did we get here, you know? And it's because all these places have not been given permission. They have not been allowed to emerge. You know, it's a powerful practice with anyone close to you just to how could I say? To make inquiry, to make room, you know, what is it in you that wants to emerge? What is the dangerous question you have to ask, you know, like that sort of thing. And it's always a tricky thing because when we do our own inner work, when we face our own inner fears, you know, it's not just for us. If I face my own inner fears, that makes me not only more courageous in facing my own stuff, it also makes me more courageous in being able to open to who somebody else is, you know, and allowing, as it were, the stranger that I haven't seen in them to step forward. So there are, you know, potentially these strangers inside the people we love, you know, these strangers that, you know, haven't stepped forward yet, that we have yet to meet. And there are also strangers inside ourselves. You know, there's parts of ourselves that we don't know. And it's tricky because so much of the psyche is, as it were, in potentiality. You know, the self is not a fixed, ready-made thing. It's always in flux, and there's always growth, and there's always edges, and this sort of thing. You know, and again, am I so crusted over with expectations and stories that I've lost the ability to surprise myself, you know? You know, what dangerous, unsettling part of myself wants to emerge? You know, what dangerous question am I not facing yet? You know, that kind of thing. Jung talked a lot about the unknown in the psyche, and he characterized it in terms of these sort of three broad areas: shadow, anima or animus, and self. And shadow is the stuff that is sort of the morally questionable stuff. In particular, it's a lot of the stuff that, like, when we were young, we were told that's naughty, you know? And of course, we want to be good little boys and good little girls, so we don't want to do the naughty stuff, you know, that sort of thing. But sometimes the naughty stuff is anger, for example. You know, anger is often something shamed. And, you know, it's true that I shouldn't be going around blasting anger at everyone I see, but part of being a healthy person is owning my anger, being in touch with my anger. Part of being a healthy person is being in touch with my sexuality or my sadness or my grief, you know, all these things. So part of the shadow, part of the what's been othered into the shadow are the parts of us that have been shamed or the parts of us that have been wounded. But it's curious, parts of the shadow also are actually quite wonderful. They're all the strengths. They're all the incredible talents and gifts that we're not ready for yet, you know? And we all have that stuff, you know? All these ways that we could be living a bigger life, making more of a contribution, but it kind of scares the bejeebers out of us, you know? And so we're like, it's like buried, you know? And so it's not always that the stranger inside of us is sometimes, you know, sometimes the stranger is someone weak and wounded who needs our care. Sometimes the stranger inside of us is someone heroic that kind of threatens us, you know? I mean, ultimately, many of the Eastern traditions would say that the ultimate stranger inside of us is God himself. You know, this is the basic teaching of Hinduism, that Atman, innermost self, is completely identical to Brahman, cosmic consciousness, you know. And so that, you know, the ultimate stranger is God himself. And so what would it mean simply to make a little more room for the stranger within yourself? For the mystery within yourself? You know, what would it mean simply to allow yourself to open an inquiry with, who are these strangers within me? You know, what do they want? What do they offer? You know, what would it mean to be more open to the stranger within a dear friend or a lover? You know, to see the face that of that person that you've never seen before, you know? And as scary as that moment might be, chances are very good that the relationship would be so much deeper if you could both, you know, integrate these faces that you hadn't seen before. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. So a variety of quotes today. The great storyteller La Fontaine says, "The person often meets his destiny on the road he took to avoid it." I love that. There's actually a classic fable from the, and I don't know what tradition it's from, but it's somewhere in the Middle East. And, you know, a man was walking one day, let's say in Jerusalem, and he comes around the corner and he meets death. And they're both kind of shocked. And the man takes the opportunity, he just runs off, and he gets in a carriage, and he tries to get as far away as possible, and he goes all the way to Damascus, or something like that. And then he thinks, all right, I'm safe now, I'm far away. And he's sitting in a cafe the next day in Damascus, and death comes to him and says, it's your time. And the guy is shocked, and he says, how did you know to find me here? And Death said, well, I knew all along I was going to meet you in Damascus. That's how I was surprised to see you yesterday in Jerusalem. Goethe, the polymath, says, know thyself. Know thyself? If I knew myself, I'd run away. You know, and there's something very real in that, you know. What are the parts of ourselves from which we have run away, you know? And what would it mean to open a conversation? Two from Dostoevsky. The first is a little bit uncharacteristic for him. Love the animals, love the plants, love everything. If you love everything, you'll perceive the divine mystery in things. Once you perceive it, you'll begin to comprehend everything better, and you will come at last to love the whole world with an all-embracing love. And then a little more characteristic for Dostoevsky, he says, there are things which a man is afraid to tell even to himself, and every decent man has a number of such things stored away in his mind. Nietzsche says quite simply, one always has exaggerated ideas about what one doesn't know. And it's true, as long as the unknown, it's overwhelming. And once we're in conversation, then it becomes a different thing. Pirandello says, solitude is never where you are. It is always where you are not, and it is only possible with a stranger present. Whatever the place, whoever the person, it must be one who is wholly ignorant concerning you and concerning which or whom you are equally ignorant, so that will and sensation remain suspended and confused and anxious uncertainty, with the ceasing of all affirmation on your part, your own inner consciousness ceases at the same time. True solitude is to be found in the place that lives a life of its own, but which holds for you no familiar footprint, speaks no voice, and where accordingly the stranger is yourself. That's a really deep quote. From T.S. Eliot, O my soul, be prepared for the coming of the stranger. Be prepared for him who knows how to ask questions. Anne Mara Lindbergh, that remarkable woman, says simply, life itself is always pulling you away from the understanding of life. And it's true that sometimes in inner growth we confront the stranger, sometimes just life hands us a challenge and a new part of us comes out because of the challenge, you know. Frederick Franck says, astonishing, getting older and older, I still stand here at the window, watching as if I've never watched anything like it before. Wrens, juncos, and purple finches picking the seeds strewn on the pile of frozen snow. Though my breath condenses onto the fog of the cold window pane, I still see bare branches chasing their shadows in the icy wind, black threads of water crinkling through the fissures of the frozen river. And I'm aware that what I'm seeing is no more, no less than the great mystery, that of being here at all, that of seeing it, as from the other side of a mirror, snow, birds, my breath still condensing, that breath that started so long ago as my first cry. It's a remarkable description of a deep state of mindfulness. Ram Dass says quite simply, the art of life is to stay wide awake and vulnerable, yet at the same time sit with the mystery and awe and with the unbearable pain to just be with it all. I've been growing into that wonderful catchphrase, be here now, for the last 40 years. And as you probably know, Ram Dass became very famous in the 1960s when he wrote a book, Be Here Now. The author Peter Matthiessen says, in this very breath that we take now lies the secret that all the great teachers tried to tell us. From Father Henry Nouwen, remarkable man, hospitality means primarily the creation of a free space where the stranger can enter and become a friend instead of an enemy. Hospitality is not to change people, but to offer them space where change can take place. It is not to bring men and women over to our side, but to offer freedom not to be disturbed, not disturbed by dividing lines. That one is so beautiful. Hugh Prother says, just when I think I've learned the way to live, life changes. So true. Ann Dillard says, our life is a faint tracing on the surface of mystery. A Billy Joel lyric you may recognize, why were you so surprised that you never saw the stranger? Did you ever let your lover see the stranger in yourself? And of course, that song, it's about many things. Among other things, it appears to be about self-gratification, but it's the lyrics are deep, and that line in particular is very powerful, even just read literally. A few from David White. This line, that it's the last line of one of his poems, the stranger's love is the best of all. And I heard what David talking about this, and he said, you know, he wrote the poem, he wrote that last line, and then he thought about it. Is that really true? Is the stranger's love best of all? Like, is it better than like your spouse's love or your best friend's love? But then he realized that moment when we're actually seeing the stranger in our best friend or in our spouse, and then we're being loved by that stranger, that is the best of all. That is the richest, you know? He also said, are you willing to be shocked by who you find within yourself? That's a powerful question. And then another quote by him, what we are about to come or afraid of becoming always trumps and rules over what we think we already are. So this whole idea of the part of ourself that is emerging, the stranger, is so much more powerful than the self-identity that I've constructed in my head. Nidia Prakash says, in any relationship, there's the moment when a person who was part of you just an instant ago becomes surrealistically familiar stranger. At that moment, inertia and denial can only delay the inevitable. Jacqueline Gunn says, sometimes the closer you are to the truth, the harder it is to see. Very simple. The sex therapist Alexandra Katakaris says, caring is open-hearted, keeping us available to transmit love to a stranger through simple eye contact and without condition. This is not the opportunistic sizing up of sexual cruising. Instead, it's the felt recognition of the divinity and humanity of another person. She's extraordinary, Miss Katakaris. Mitt Kalantri says, most of us start as strangers and eventually again become strangers. And Kristen Evangelou says, To be human is to be heart-fed and valiantly vulnerable, lion-hearted and confident in what can be offered to you and what being given in return. Insecurity is something to absorb in order to progress. Much of the adventure in life is not knowing what is next, and it takes distinct bravery to get to the place where you are willing to be at ease with the mystery of what's to come.